You're listening to the Ayn Rand Institute Live podcast series.
The New Moral Case for Fossil Fuels by Alex Epstein.
So in fall 1998, I was a freshman at Duke University, and I was on a track to become, I thought, what we would call now a tech entrepreneur. At least that's what I wanted to become. And so I was studying physics for engineers, and I was not enjoying it very much. And in the library on the freshman campus at Duke, there was a book called Letters of Ayn Rand, this book. And I had heard about Ayn Rand in high school, but I had never actually read her. I heard that she was very logical, and this intrigued me, but for various reasons, I hadn't gotten around to reading her. But I picked up this book because I didn't want to be studying physics. And I opened it, and I found this passage. And this was her early on in her letter to Barry Goldwater. And I'll let you read it, and then I just want to read the highlighted part of it. But when I read it, it really struck me, there's something incredibly clear about the way this person thinks. And in particular, this bolded part. She says she's criticizing Goldwater, but it is dangerously misleading to call these principles ancient and tested truths. They were new, untested, and unprecedented. The great achievement of the founding fathers was the fact that they created a political system fundamentally different from any that had ever existed before in the whole of human history. And at the time, I had been exposed to different conservative ideas and liberal ideas and libertarian ideas. But I had never heard this point, which just was kind of obvious to me, which I took out of this, which is that if we're pro-American, why do we talk about it in terms of being conservative? Like, what the American system was this revolutionary system. And just in reading this, I just thought, this person is on a different level than anyone I've ever read. And I remember at the time one of my heroes was Thomas Sowell, and he's somebody I still admire a lot. But I just felt like, oh, this is a new level of clarity. And what I want to talk about today is how I believe objectivist philosophy in general is an incredible tool for clarity, and then how it's helped me personally with a particular idea, which is the moral case for fossil fuels. So I think of objectivist philosophy as the ultimate clarity tool. And so I think of there's a whole category of issues in the world which we can call 4C issues. So they're crucial, complex, confusing, and controversial. And these issues people are arguing about all the time, just like they were about conservatism versus liberalism. And on these issues, I believe what Ayn Rand has identified about philosophy can be incredibly clarifying. And more broadly, I have a belief that objectivist philosophy in general is very practical, and that people can use it in a way that's very practical, not just for their own happiness, and that's the most important thing, but related, they can create enormous value in every different field possible. And I remember in 1999, I actually didn't go to the OCON. It wasn't called OCON at the time, but it was a conference in Lake Tahoe. I guess it's 20 years ago now. And a friend of mine at the time, who was an objectivist at Duke, this guy Aaron Patzer, who later became a very successful tech entrepreneur, he told me, "Oh, like I'm going to this conference." So I looked up and saw what's being covered at this conference, and there was a lecture by someone I had never heard of. Now I have definitely heard of him, named John Allison. And it was called something like Objectivism, the Competitive Advantage. And I learned, oh, wow, this is somebody who's a very successful CEO in the banking industry. And he is arguing that objectivism is a competitive advantage. And I really loved this line of thinking. And it was at odds with what I had been told both to some degree within the objectivist community and certainly outside by, you know, people in my family and other things like that, which is that if you believe these things, that's going to be a market liability. It's going to be hard for you to succeed in any kind of conventional sense. And I really just did not believe that this was true. So as I sort of indicated before, my goal today is I want to share the story of a clarifying and influential idea that has been made possible by objectivist philosophy, which is the moral case for fossil fuels, and that also continues to improve using objectivist philosophy. And I'm going to talk about some of the improvements that I've been making in it. And the goal is twofold. One is I want you to get either excited about the idea of the moral case for fossil fuels or even more excited, but then also I hope to motivate some of you to leverage objectivist philosophy in all kinds of different fields in somewhat similar way that I have in the field of energy. So the moral case for fossil fuels, in terms of the world of books and ideas, let alone the world of objectivist books and ideas, it's definitely been quite an influential book. So it's been a New York Times bestseller, Wall Street Journal bestseller. And in terms of people who've been interested in it and asked my advice or had me speak, like pretty much every branch of government I've in some way consulted with has cited it. People are mentioning it in Congress. The arguments get repeated in different kinds of court cases. And definitely in the fossil fuel industry, in particular the energy industry more broadly, this idea of the moral case for fossil fuels is quite well known. Like if you meet a CEO in the energy industry and you ask, have you heard of the moral case for fossil fuels, or Alex Epstein, they probably have. Now, it was one, I get things like this fairly frequently, but I think this was last year, maybe the year before, I was at a conference and the Secretary of Energy, Rick Perry, spoke, and I didn't see his speech, but he had known me through the book in part, and so we were meeting that morning, and he said, hey, did you hear my speech? Like, I was giving your ideas, and then you saw this headline, like, Rick Perry calls shift away from fossil fuels immoral. Now, the point is definitely not that Rick Perry is an objectivist or that we agree on everything at all, but it's that there was something about this idea of the moral case for fossil fuels and the way it was explained that resonated with him and resonated with a lot of people, and that they found clarifying where they hadn't found everything else on energy clarifying before. And I believe that what's distinctively clarifying about the moral case for fossil fuels has to do with objectivist philosophy. Now, I think the most influence that the ideas have had center around what our business model is. So I run a company called the Center for Industrial Progress, which I started in 2011. Before then, I worked, as Anu mentioned, I worked at ARI for 7 years, and part of that helped me a lot with developing these ideas. And CIP, as we call it for short, it's a for-profit think tank. And so this is an interesting kind of model because we have controversial ideas, but we don't raise money from donors to pay us to broadcast those ideas. We actually have clients, mostly corporate clients, who pay us for those ideas. So for example, if there's an oil company who wants to fight for their freedom, then they might come to us and then they'll say, hey, can you help us create better messaging so we can persuade different kinds of what they would call stakeholders? And that's an interesting kind of thing because I'm somebody with very controversial ideas, and yet corporations are paying for those ideas, or at least some form of those ideas, and they're paying for it to enhance their bottom line. So there's this interesting relationship between these are controversial ideas, and yet there's some way in which they're appealing to persuade new people. So the three sections I want to cover today. So one is going to be how objectivism has helped me think more clearly about fossil fuels, and that's going to be the main part of it. And then two is how objectivism helps me communicate more persuasively. And then three is how it's helping me continue to improve rapidly at both. For some reason, the screen says they're all number one, but you can substitute that in your head. So one quick note on how I got interested in this field. And so I see some of the people in this room were around when I was both uninterested in this field and interested in this field. So I've since I was 20 years old, really, I decided, okay, I want to do something with philosophy and something practical. But there was never any real subject that captivated me. I was interested in philosophy in general, which is a great subject, but there was no specific issue in the culture that really captivated me. And I had different bosses at ARI, and they would tell me, like, hey, you should specialize in something, and I think they were right, but, like, it took me a long time to figure out something that I was really intrigued by, and I think the reason energy intrigued me was kind of accidental. I was researching the history of John D. Rockefeller, and I just had this realization, oh my gosh, energy is the industry that powers every other industry. And so our thinking about energy is incredibly high leverage. If we can think more clearly about energy issues, then everything in life can become more abundant and more affordable and more reliable. And if we make mistakes thinking about energy, then everything in life can get worse. And that really motivated me to think about, okay, how can I help people think better about energy, and how can I do that using philosophy? Now, get ready to cue the video, by the way. Don't quite run it yet, but this is... this view that, oh, philosophy is going to be of practical use in resolving energy issues or anything, that's a very controversial kind of view. And when I testified in front of the Senate, Senator Barbara Boxer explained that philosophy had no place in energy.
This is the Environment and Public Works Committee. I think it's interesting we have a philosopher here talking about an issue.
It's to teach you how to think more clearly.
Well, you don't have to teach me how to think more clearly. You don't have to try running.
So that's that, but thank you. That's funny. So, one thing that I got from Ayn Rand was the idea that philosophy is not only a practical subject, but in some ways the most practical subject, because it gives us a fundamental framework for thinking and acting. And I'm going to talk about that a lot more in a minute. So I, from the get-go, I think because Ayn Rand was such a big influence on me, I had this idea of philosophy as just this incredible tool of clarity. And really, I think of my motivation in life as the relentless pursuit of clarity. So it always seemed to me very valuable to learn more and more and more about objectivist philosophy and objectivist method, because then I could think more clearly about different kinds of issues. I think fundamentally what the right philosophy gives us is it gives us a framework, and I want to talk about how I'm using that term. So framework, if you're building something physical, it's your starting structure. So there can be a framework for a building or a framework for a car, and that starting structure influences everything else about what you're building. And I believe the same thing is true for a thought process or a communication process, including a conversation. Every thought process we have, every act of communication involves some sort of starting structure. And you can divide up the structure in different ways, but today I'm going to divide it into methods, assumptions, and values. And what I think objectivism does incredibly well is two things. One is it gives us a lot of clarity on ways that people go wrong in these domains, where they have wrong thinking methods, wrong assumptions, and wrong values in the sense of being anti-human, anti-life values. And it also gives us positively really amazing thinking methods and accurate assumptions or accurate understanding of the nature of the world and man's place in it and pro-human view of values. So I want to apply this and show you how this has helped my own thinking with energy. So we'll start out with the issue of with methods. So in the realm of energy over the years, and even pretty early on, I noticed that there are some real issues with the thinking methods that we use when we're discussing different forms of energy. And so one is that I noticed that, well, we tend to talk about fossil fuels and nuclear, we tend to look at the negative context. So we tend to look only for negatives, and not we in this room, but as a culture, I should say, we tend to be biased. We also tend to be sloppy. And I'll give some examples in a second, versus the right way of looking at anything is looking at it in its full context, and that includes being even-handed and precise. So in terms of the bias, when I started learning about energy, I realized pretty quickly two things. One is that energy, that really abundant energy production, is fundamental to human flourishing, because that's the industry that powers every other industry that gives us the values we need to live. And then two, abundant energy production is very, very difficult. The fossil fuel industry has this unprecedented achievement of being able to provide us energy that's versatile and affordable and reliable and scales to billions of people. And no industry had ever done that before, and still no industry has ever done that. So this one industry has this achievement that is indispensable to the level of human flourishing, standard of living that we enjoy. And yet I noticed that in the conversations about energy, this was almost never mentioned. So for example, people would say, oh, well, alternatives, particularly renewable alternatives, they can do all the same things as fossil fuels. And I would just, even early on, I could see, well, for instance, there's no at all renewable solution for airplane flight. Or maybe even more important than that if there's something more important than that, would be agriculture. The whole world depends on industrial agriculture, and that's hugely powered by liquid-fueled machines derived from oil. Their fuel is derived from oil, and natural gas-derived fertilizer. And literally, humanity starving or being fed depends on these fossil fuels, and yet nobody was talking about them. They just act like, oh yeah, there's no big advantage there, and yet they would only focus on the negatives. Now, one kind of funny thing that I discovered is that there was somebody who had a pretty good explanation of what was going wrong with this thought process, and he was addressing this idea that, oh, well, renewable energy will inevitably catch up with or surpass fossil fuel energy because it's using the sun and the wind, which are free and forever. So this idea, oh, renewable is inevitable, and that's inevitably going to be as good as fossil fuels. And so it's this guy. Now, he wasn't talking about solar and wind, but he was talking about another promising form of renewable energy called hazelnut energy. So play the clip.
New Scientist magazine reported on Wednesday that in the future, cars could be powered by hazelnuts. That's encouraging, yeah, considering an 8-ounce jar of hazelnuts costs about $9. Yeah, I got an idea for a car that runs on bald eagle heads and Fabergé eggs.
So, but it's renewable, right? Hazelnut energy is renewable. It comes from the sun, so why isn't it free and forever? And what he's getting at, I mean, he doesn't know it because he's a member of Artists Against Fracking last time I checked, but that energy is a process. So when you're looking at different forms of energy, you need to look at the full process of each form of energy, including all the different kinds of materials used for mining and transportation and everything else that you need to make the sun actually give you usable energy. And the more I looked into this, the more I could see the huge thing that was running into, that was giving all the renewables problems and that still gives them problems, is the problem of they are not a reliable fuel source because they're coming from the sun and the wind, which are very intermittent fuel sources. And so I got some research, like primary source data from Germany, which was supposedly the model, and you had this idea that, oh, well, the sun and the wind, even if they're both not working all the time, they'll balance each other out. And I looked in Germany, and it's like, well, no, actually, there are times when both are basically at zero. They call this dark calm. And so, well, if you don't have a reliable fuel source, if sometimes your fuel source can go to 0% availability, then that means you need to have 100% reliable fuel source all of the time. And what happens in practice is with these renewable energy sources, you have to not only build this unreliable energy system, but then you need a 100% reliable energy system. And so you just always have the costs go way up. But the most important part of this for our purposes today is that the way this is being looked at in our culture is people are just looking for negatives about fossil fuels and they're not looking for positives. So people are blinded to the actual nature of fossil fuels. Whereas coming from a better framework, I was on this premise of, well, I have to look at the full context. I have to be even-handed. I have to be precise. And what that's enabling me to do is to be more objective and to get much clearer. So you'll often hear this term of capacity. Oh yeah, solar and, you know, this much solar capacity or this much wind capacity. And what they're referring to is the theoretical maximum if the sun is shining and the wind is blowing. But that's a super sloppy term because the theoretical maximum of a nuclear power plant is very close to its actual performance, whereas the theoretical maximum of solar and wind is 3 or 4 times its performance, and it will never reach that maximum in a reliable way. So I mentioned part of looking at the full context is being even-handed and precise versus biased and sloppy. One area of sloppiness that I noticed in people's thinking methods was there was a tendency toward sloppiness about climate. So here's an example. Al Gore, you would hear people say, oh, climate change is real and sea levels are rising. And if I'm on the premise of thinking about things precisely, I want to know, that's not a very good statement because I want to know, okay, what does it mean that it's real? How significant is it? What's the magnitude of it? And then I would look into different claims and I would see, oh, well, Al Gore says 20-foot rise in sea levels. And then the United Nations might say a 2-foot rise in sea levels. Well, those are totally different. It's like, how am I going to possibly make a determination if you're being that vague about things? It would be like with a prescription drug. If they say, like, one person, if they say, oh, this drug has side effects, therefore you shouldn't use it. But is the side effect going to kill you, or is the side effect a rash? And is the benefit it's going to save your life, or is the benefit non-existent? Just as you couldn't think about prescription drugs intelligently if you weren't even-handed and precise about the benefits and side effects, so we can't think about fossil fuels objectively if we're not precise, even-handed, precise about the benefits and side effects. And yet it is completely rampant in our culture. It's not just dumb people. It's smart people who are just completely looking at just the negative context. And this goes to the issue of framework. If you don't have a really good explicit framework, if you are a really smart person, that can actually just amplify irrationality. Whereas having an explicit framework, I just found, was incredibly useful in both identifying what was going wrong and also how to go right. Another issue in framework I mentioned is the issue of assumptions. So you could think of assumptions as premises about cause and effect, how the world works. And in particular, in the realm of energy, there are premises about human nature and then the nature of our environment, of the environment we live in, the planet we live on. And what I noticed about the premises and assumptions guiding the energy discussion is that the dominant way of thinking about our environment is what I would call the delicate nurturer view. So the idea is that Earth is naturally stable, it's safe, and it's sufficient. So you often hear about, oh, we have a stable climate, and you know, our naturally safe climate, and naturally clean water. So the idea is that absent us screwing things up, you know, we basically live in the Garden of Eden. People wouldn't put it that way, but that's kind of the assumption. You know, they think of the Earth as just this nice thing with a smiley face that's very nice, but then once we start emitting things, then that makes the Earth inhospitable and angry. And really, I got much of this from Ayn Rand. Like, Ayn Rand in her writings, she doesn't focus on environmental issues, but when she does, she does in the sense of, particularly when she talks about productiveness, you know, my summary of the truth, and which I think is also her view, is that the actual nature of our environment is wild potential. So it's dynamic, dangerous, and deficient. And what I've observed is that depending on which basic view you have of our environment, that is going to radically affect your predictions, and it's going to radically affect even how you view the world around you. A related set of assumptions has to do with how you view human beings. So people who view nature as a delicate nurturer tend to view human beings as polluter parasites. So our activities, we make the Earth dirty, and we quickly squander its very limited resources. Versus on the other view, the view that I hold is no, human beings are not polluter parasites, we are perfecter producers. So we take a naturally dangerous and deficient planet and we make it far safer and more abundant. Now, of course, we can do irrational things, but our core nature, the thing that we do with respect to our environment, is we make it a much better place to live. And so from a humanist perspective, in particular, an objectivist perspective in general, the Earth has never been a better place to live. And yet, from what I would call an anti-human perspective, or from an environmentalist perspective, people think of, oh, the planet is in horrible shape. It's like somehow we're living to 80, but the planet is horrible. So these kinds of assumptions turn out to have incredible power in how people assess the world and how they make predictions. So here's an example of somebody very prominent. And in my book, The Moral Case for Fossil Fuels, the first chapter is called The Secret History of Fossil Fuels. And one thing it has is the predictions of a lot of the environmental thought leaders in the culture about what will happen in the future. But it's their predictions about what has happened today from 30 or 40 years ago. And I find that time after time after time, they're just totally wrong. They predicted the world was going to end because of either catastrophic climate change or catastrophic pollution or catastrophic resource depletion, and yet the world is better than ever. So an example is John Holdren, who was the leading science advisor to President Obama. And Holdren for years has been saying that industrial civilization in general and fossil fuel and use in particular is leading to our demise. And in the mid-80s, he made this prediction that by the year 2020, 1 billion people have died due to climate-related deaths, particularly due to famine, because we would have emitted all this CO2 and it would have made our planet inhospitable. Well, it's almost 2020, and fortunately we have data for how many people are actually dying due to climate-related causes, including things like famine and drought, but also wildfires, extreme heat, extreme cold. And what the data show is that even as our emissions have gone up, or actually related to our emissions going up, climate-related deaths have been plummeting, and they continue to plummet, and even since my book came out, they've continued to go down as well in the last several years. Now, how is this possible? Well, if you have the delicate nurturer view of the environment, or of our environment, or if you have the polluter-parasite view of human beings, this makes no sense, because clearly we've had a big impact on our environment, particularly on CO2 levels, and yet somehow our environment has gotten better, at least from the perspective of climate-related deaths. But if you have the wild potential view and the perfecter-producer view, then it just makes total sense. You think, oh yeah, well, of course we're a lot safer from climate, because we've taken the naturally dangerous climate and we've made it unnaturally safe through things like heating for when it's cold. Cold-related deaths are still a much greater problem, actually, than heat-related deaths, but also cooling ourselves when it's hot, building very durable buildings, having all sorts of methods of avoiding deaths from drought, like irrigation, drought relief convoys, all of these things being tied in a direct or indirect way to cheap, plentiful, reliable energy from fossil fuels. So it was fascinating to me that basically everyone had this view that climate is becoming more dangerous, that we're really going to be overwhelmed by it. And this has been predicted for decades and decades and decades. And it defies common sense. Like, you just think common sense, are we safer from climate now or 300 years ago? You would say, you'd think like, oh yeah, well, if you really knew what climate was like to experience then, you'd think, well, obviously it's better now. And yet people think like, oh my gosh, we have an emergency, we have a catastrophe. And what this shows, at least so far, is that even if we've done things to make climate somewhat more naturally dangerous, and I don't think we can really know that one way or another, whether it's actually more dangerous, but we know that our experience of it is much, much safer. And I just want to point out, this is not dumb people who believe this. This is smart people. The whole establishment who's thinking about climate-related issues has this delicate nurturer perspective. And so they not only have made wrong predictions to date, but they continue to make wrong predictions about the future. An example that I've been reading recently is there's a guy named Michael Mann, who's one of the most prominent climate scientists in the world. And you should check out his book. You should sort of check out his book, or at least see if you can preview it on Google, because I'm not a big fan of paying him. But he has a book called The Madhouse Effect. And if you just look up like the Madhouse Effect on food, he'll talk about is, oh, CO2 emissions are having this effect and this effect, and this is going to threaten food supplies. But he doesn't mention that the only reason that we have food supplies for 7.5 billion people is because of the unique energy production capability of the fossil fuel industry. He doesn't mention that at all. And you can see what's going on. Well, one is he doesn't have this, he's not following an explicit framework of being even-handed and precise, so he just looks for negatives and not positives with fossil fuels. And then two, he has this delicate nurturer view of the planet and this polluter-parasite view of human beings. So all he can imagine is us impacting the world and the world becoming an angry place that somehow, you know, bites us, versus actually looking at, oh wait, it's also possible that we'll continue to make the world a much better place. Now, a final category, and all of these categories are very related, is the category of values. So philosophy deals obviously with values, things we should act to gain and or keep. And one thing I noticed, and again, I got this from Ayn Rand, is that the standard of value that people are using, so the way people are measuring good and bad when they're talking about this is a good policy toward fossil fuels, this is a bad policy, or this form of energy is good, or this form of energy is bad, or this use of energy is good, or this use of energy is bad, is this idea of being green, of having a minimal impact or minimum impact on our environment. And when I was 18, even before I decided I wanted to do philosophy professionally, I was in a class at Duke, and there was a very environmentalist skewed set of classes, and somebody pointed me to, I remember the first thing I ever read was by Mike Berliner on this topic, and because the Ayn Rand Institute had some really interesting things on Earth Day, and I read those, and I read some stuff by Ayn Rand, and I just got this idea, this is in my own words, but that human beings survive by impacting our environment. We transform an environment that is dangerous and deficient into one that is safe and abundant. So if we survive by impact and somebody's standard of value is non-impact, then that is an anti-human, anti-life value, at least an anti-human life value. And I really hated the green movement from then on. And then later I got this idea of, well, you should value human life. And I often like to use the term human flourishing because that sort of captures the full potential of human life. But this was, it was possible for me to see this really clearly because I had philosophy and because I had these ideas explicitly and because I knew the contrasts and why I disagreed with the contrasts. So a set of examples that I like to use that to help people see the difference between being green versus being pro-human, being on a minimum impact standard versus being on a human flourishing standard, is I like these are, I think, examples that can drive it home. So one is, if we want to be green, if our ancestors had wanted to be green, if they wanted to minimize their impact, would they have taken a patch of dirt and trees in the Northeast United States and turned it into New York City? Like, would Greenpeace have given thumbs up or thumbs down to the building of New York City? I don't see any thumbs. Yeah. Okay. Two thumbs down in one case. Yeah, definitely. And so that will often strike people. Or here's another one. You know, many of you have children, or all of you are in some sense part of family, so I don't have any children at this point, but I'm the first of four children. And so starting in 1980, my parents decided to self-replicate four times, or they decided three times, but then they had twins at the end. And the question is, if Sierra Club or Greenpeace had advising them, would they give that thumbs up or thumbs down? If you want to minimize your impact on the planet, should you self-replicate one or more times? No, thumbs down, right? It's like much better from an impact perspective to live out of a running Hummer than to have a child. And it's true, right? But it's interesting because people will see, oh my, this is what I kind of realized when I was 18, that, oh my gosh, this is something that's saying we should measure our goodness by how little we impact, and yet that means no cities, no children. And then a final one that I think really drives it home is, which is a greener country, North Korea or South Korea? So North Korea, besides Kim's home, is like the perfect green country, right? You can see just one light, basically, you know, one area of light. So it's it should you know, win like Hero of the Environment. I think Time offers those awards. And yet South Korea has all of this light pollution. And so I'll ask people, well, okay, which? So one is the greenest country in the world. So people are usually uncomfortable with the idea that North Korea turns out to be their ideal in action. But then which country has a better environment, North Korea or South Korea? So which has cleaner air, cleaner water, better sanitation? Where do you feel safer from climate? Right, South Korea. So this is interesting. So being green doesn't even get you a good environment. And if you understand the pro-human perspective, this makes total sense because human survival depends on impacting our environment, transforming it from, again, dangerous and deficient to safe and abundant. And so the, you know, what I would call the human flourishing framework, that just sort of makes sense of everything, and it explains why we're thinking about things in such a wrong way. And just to show how powerful these frameworks are, this is an example I've thought of in the last year, but it really strikes me. And just to give you a little context before I show you the slide, if I'm saying energy is fundamental to human flourishing, cheap, plentiful, reliable energy is fundamental to human flourishing, and then 3 billion people in the world have virtually no energy. So those are two facts. A third fact is that in our culture today, people talk about energy all the time, like energy in one form or another, including its environmental impacts. That is a daily news subject. And yet, how often do people talk about 3 billion people not having energy and the desirability of them having a modern life, including a lot of energy? Like, almost never, right? But how often do we talk about polar bears? Like, all the time. So like a polar bear has to move from one piece of ice to another, as a society, we're just apoplectic and we can't take it. Now, polar bear is actually my favorite animal, so it's not being against polar bears, but there's something that's really odd. And if you understand the role of philosophy, seeing it here as the role of frameworks, it makes total sense because we have this framework where we're not measuring good by human flourishing, we're measuring it by non-impact. So when we look at our activities, and our opportunities, what we see is, oh my gosh, we might have done something to change the lives of polar bears. That's impact. Let's stop doing that. That's our whole moral focus. Whereas from a human flourishing perspective, you see, how can more people flourish? How can we flourish more? What conditions need to be in place for that? And yet, if you're not on that human flourishing perspective, you don't see that. So it just continues to amaze me and fascinate me how much power our philosophical frameworks have and how much power objectivist philosophy gives us both to see what's going wrong with thinking and then to see how to think about things accurately. So I just want to summarize, example of this. I forgot I wanted to mention this one. So another example of how this minimum impact focus is manifest is that when people talk about alternatives to fossil fuels, like it's interesting that they're not really focused on, if they say, oh, I care so much about climate change, as they would call it, they're not focused on, okay, let's find the cheapest, most plentiful, most reliable source of energy that has very little in terms of CO2 emissions. The whole focus is on renewable energy, and very conspicuously, it omits nuclear energy. And conspicuously, the green movement, which claims to care so much about how dangerous climate change will be to our future, that movement is the most anti-nuclear movement, and that's been opposing nuclear power for decades. Even though nuclear power doesn't have that fundamental reliability problem that solar and wind has, and you have nuclear power successfully producing significant portions of power around the world. So what's going on? Well, a big part of what's going on is people don't have human flourishing as their standard. They have non-impact as their standard. So their focus is, oh, let's find the most natural form of energy. Let's use the sun and the wind. And there's this fetish, really, for, oh, we need to use the sun and the wind, and that's going to be the path towards something good. And they're willing to do it in a way that, even on their own premise that CO2 emissions is a problem, they're willing to do it in a way that makes it impossible to reduce CO2 emissions in any meaningful way, except through massive deindustrialization and death. And what's interesting is most people who are adopting what we can call the anti-impact framework, most people don't realize that they're adopting it. And one thing I'm going to mention soon is when you can point out the frameworks explicitly, you can win a lot of people over, because most people are inadvertently adopting the framework, not deliberately adopting. There are certain leaders who are deliberately adopting it, but they don't even want to make it explicit, because if they make it explicit, then it's very hard to persuade other people to do something that's anti-human. So my overall summary of this would be, in terms of the framework, I think of like the two frameworks for purposes of looking at energy anyways. There's the anti-impact framework, and so that's the one that is looking in terms of, let's minimize our impact, human beings are polluter parasites, nature is a delicate nurturer, and I believe because of these assumptions, it tends to be very biased and sloppy in favor of the so-called natural energy sources, like sun, solar and wind-based, and then very biased against the supposedly unnatural ones that, like fossil fuels and nuclear, versus human flourishing framework tells us we just want the best form of energy for human flourishing. So we don't assume that all human impacts are bad. We know human impact is necessary, and so what we want is the energy choices that have the most benefits with the fewest drawbacks. And we don't care whether they come from the sun or the wind or uranium or thorium or hydrocarbons or wherever. We just want the best result for human life now and in the future. There are three charts that capture the key elements of the moral case, both in the first book and going forward. And so the first one is what I call the human flourishing hockey stick, which just shows the relationship, the correlation historically between CO2 emissions, which that essentially means fossil fuel emissions, and which historically means energy use, since fossil fuels are most of our energy use, and life expectancy. So you see this just incredible hockey stick of it's flat for thousands and thousands of years, and then it spikes up dramatically to this unprecedented level. And then life expectancy is flat, and it goes up to this unprecedented level. And then not only are people living longer, but, well, related, they have many more resources, which is what GDP captures. And not only that, But some people might think, oh, if we're living longer with more resources, then the Earth's population has to go down because the Earth only has so many resources, and yet the Earth's population goes up. So there's more people with more resources and longer lives, and it correlates to this phenomenon of these unprecedented CO2 emissions, unprecedented fossil fuel use. And the core thing that's going on is that what the fossil fuel industry has done is it has had this unprecedented achievement of cheap, plentiful, reliable energy on a scale of billions, which nobody had ever done, and still nobody has done in the same way that the fossil fuel industry has done. And what that unprecedented ability to produce energy has been indispensable to an unprecedented level of human flourishing. So that, I think, is the core of why fossil fuel use has been so moral and remains moral. And then part of what's going on with why we should continue it in the future is, one, now this just captures a little bit of it, but that there are no near-term substitutes that can play that same role, that can produce that unprecedented level of human flourishing for us, let alone the billions of people who still aspire to it. So I explained this chart before. And then in terms of, if we look at the future, are there any drawbacks in the future that should make us want to cut back on fossil fuels, which means cut back on energy? Well, the only plausible one would be climate-related, because in terms of conventional pollution, like air and water, we have technology now where we can have way less of that. And in terms of the availability of the stuff, we have technology where we have decades and decades and decades and decades fairly easily accessible using current technology. So the only kind of concern is climate-related, and yet what we've seen in the last 40 years, what captures what we can expect with climate-related issues, is that even though I do believe we have a warming influence on climate, any drawbacks of that influence have been far, far, far outweighed by the incredible benefits of fossil fuel use, not just in general, but in particular just in terms of climate protection. So even just in terms of climate protection, the power fossil fuels give us to change our environment, to make it a safer and more abundant place, that has made our climate much safer when people predicted it would become much more dangerous, and I believe that will continue in the future. Now, there are tons and tons and tons of details, which is why I wrote a whole book and why I'm writing a whole second book, but that is at the high level, I think those three slides capture a lot of the moral case for fossil fuels now and going forward. So my conclusion is, in the coming decades, we should be using more fossil fuels, not less. And of course, we should always be seeking superior alternatives, and that includes better ways of using fossil fuels, and then truly economic alternatives, including, I believe, we need to decriminalize nuclear power. So I mentioned that the longest part of today would be about the core moral case for fossil fuels, how objectivist philosophy helped me get clear on this issue. Now I want to talk about, in much briefer form, how it's helped me communicate clearly, and then also how it's helped me both think and communicate clearly as I work on the second version of it. So when I released my book, Moral Case for Fossil Fuels, in November of 2014, like many people, I did a kind of book tour, and I talked to a lot of different audiences. And one of the benefits of talking to audiences is that I got to learn what's effective and what's not effective when talking about different kinds of issues. And I had a really wrong assumption at the beginning, which was that the way to really motivate people about my approach would be to just give them the most provocative or shocking facts. So for instance, this fact about climate-related deaths is shocking to people. And I thought, okay, well, if I tell people that, then they'll be really interested. And it wasn't that that wasn't true at all. People were interested. But as I started testing out other things, I saw, no, wait, there's something that's much more motivating to people that I didn't expect. And that was that actually what I've shared with you today is that people found the framework most interesting. And it was uncanny to me how, no matter what the audience, this was true. So you can look online, and I'll talk, I've talked at all kinds of, a lot of the major universities, but I remember one in particular, I was talking at Wellesley College, which is definitely not a pro-fossil fuels place or any kind of traditional conservative school. But I remember I was able to make a dent, I think, on some of the people there. And if you look that on YouTube, you'll see some of what I did today in terms of I'm framing the discussion. What I found is that when I talked at the beginning about here's how I think, not here's what my conclusion about fossil fuels is, but here's what my framework is, here's how I start my thinking, what would happen is people would, that way of thinking made a lot of sense to people. They'd say, yeah, of course we should be even-handed versus biased. Of course we should be precise versus sloppy. That delicate nurturer assumption, I can see how I hold that, but it really doesn't make a lot of sense. The wild potential view is much more accurate. And yeah, I can see how the human flourishing standard is the right way to think about it because that incorporates having a good environment, but it doesn't treat the environment as something that we should sacrifice to. So it's really fascinating that even though the framework I was using wasn't common practice, in many ways, it had a lot of elements of common sense to people. And even if it wasn't fully common sense, I could explain it pretty quickly. And then what I noticed was that when I framed first and then gave the facts, people would process it in a totally different way. And you can, I teach this, I'll talk about this a little bit in my intellectual persuasion talk later, but if you just think logically in conversation, if you're talking about some heated issue and you say to somebody, you know, hey, before we get started, would you agree that we, that was funny. This is a, yeah, wind power, see, this is, the, you know, when you're talking to somebody and there's some heated issue and then would, if you just say, hey, would you agree that we should look at both the pros and the cons of every option, what's somebody gonna say? Yeah, you have to say yes, right? It's obvious. And once they do that, they're more likely to actually think of the pros and cons of every option. There's a certain kind of forced integrity, which actually in the influence literature is kind of a big idea. And what I noticed is, yeah, when I do this, when I frame first and then go to the facts and my interpretation of the facts, people, the reason it's more persuasive is not some sort of magic persuasive voodoo. It's because if you give someone a framework and they agree to the framework, their thinking will be better. And then if their thinking is better and your thinking is good, then you will be more persuasive. And maybe this seems like common sense, but I don't think it's common practice among just about anyone. And actually, a lot of the business that we do is just teaching companies how to frame their arguments in different ways, mostly in energy, but even in other fields, people are starting to see, oh yeah, I would like to be able to do this in finance. I would like to be able to do this in healthcare. But it was really interesting to me how the thing that was actually most persuasive to people was not, you know, some concrete, sexy fact or something like that or any other device, but it was just super like cold logical philosophy, but in a way that was really eye-opening to people. So we get a lot of notes from people about, you know, this what changed my way of thinking and stuff. And what I really find satisfaction in is when people talk about, oh, it's the framing, like, oh, he gave me a framework, or, you know, the way you frame the conversation makes sense. And I wasn't, at the beginning, I wasn't doing this as deliberately, but then I noticed it, and then I saw, oh, yeah, the same thing that makes me passionate about this issue and think a and have certain conclusions, if I can share that with people, then that's going to make them process, or at least gives them the opportunity to process the issue in a much different way. Now, as a little advertisement, I have a talk, and I believe it's in this room later today, on intellectual persuasion, so I'm going to get more into the issue of the role of framework and persuasion as well as some other things. If you're interested in more on this issue, a couple of resources. One is I have a podcast called The Human Flourishing Project, which talks about a bunch of things related to human flourishing, including has some talks on persuasion. But the other thing is, did you guys get the cards that they handed out on the way in? Yes. So hopefully you can find a pen, which is made of oil, by the way. And if you fill it out, if you put on your name and email address, and even if you're on our list, do that. We won't send you duplicate copies, but put it on there. And what I want to be able to do then is send you some resources, including all the resources that I mentioned in the intellectual persuasion talk. And so whether you go to that or not, I can send you those resources. That's just a super easy way for me to get it. And of course, because it's going to save trees, and that's what should motivate all of us. No. So far, I've focused on objectivist philosophy has helped me in terms of thinking much more clearly about this crucial, complex, confusing, controversial issue. And very related, it's helped me be more persuasive, not through some sort of magic, but basically by sharing the framework understanding of the right frameworks versus the wrong frameworks with other people and then having them process things differently. And I want to talk about how this is now shaping the new version of the book. Now, I said I sort of tricked you because I'm saying how it's going to shape the new version, but really the way I've even presented it today is much more framework-driven than the first version of the moral case for fossil fuels. And the way I talk about these issues is much more framework-driven now than it was 5 years ago. And one thing that when I, about a year ago, somebody suggested to me, hey, you know, you could revise the issue the publisher would really like. Then I talked to the publisher and they said, yeah, of course, we'd like an updated version. And I'd planned to do something, not cosmetic, but like, I'll just update a few things. And then I saw it, I reread it, and I really thought, oh my gosh, there's a real opportunity now to take what I've learned about framework and thinking over the last 5 years and then to apply it and to make the argument that much more persuasive. And in the last 5 years, I've had a thought over and over, which is that as hard as that first one was to write, and it was this kind of crazy process because I had 6 months to do the whole thing. It was very intense and almost traumatic at the end to finish it because it was so difficult. Like every minute I spent making that thing as good as it was worth it, because just whatever you do to market a book or an idea, like the most important thing is how good the thing is. And I don't mean how good in your own sense, but really how useful it is to the person. And I reread it and I thought, oh, this can be so much better. And then I started talking with certain people about the ideas as I thought I'm going to make this better, including some ARI people like Greg and Ankar. And I started talking to them more about it. And then I saw, oh, wait, it's not only that I can apply what I've learned in the past 5 years, but there's actually a lot more for me to think about now that I'm aware of these framework issues. So I thought, okay, I'm fortunately in a position where I can take my time to make this thing much, much better in a fundamental way. And I'll talk about a couple of aspects in which I'm working on it. So the first way, the way I think of it overall, and this might be a useful concept in any profession, is I think of when I am communicating ideas or thinking about ideas, I think about I want to give somebody a working system. So when I say working system, I mean I want to deliver them ideas in a way where those ideas are concretely useful in dealing with the complexity of their lives. So if I'm giving advice about productivity, I want to give advice about productivity in a way that when somebody actually encounters the world and all the challenges of productivity, they can actually do it. And one thing I noticed about Moral Case 1 was it was persuasive in a lot of ways, but it wasn't really a working system. And I've experienced this somewhat painfully when I would have a lot of people who would love the book, like policymakers, but they wouldn't really know how to use it to advocate for policy. So one kind of solution was that we don't charge government for things, but we would sometimes help on a volunteer basis and help people with messaging on individual things. But it was just clear to me that I now know there's a way to write the book in which the policy guidance I give is much, much clearer. And I'll explain more about that in a second, why that's true. And actually, it's the main reason is this idea of a more explicit framework. So in the first version of the book, there's like 3 pages at the beginning about framework. And that's often what people say, oh, this really influenced me the most. But I think there's a lot more to say about the issue and making it really explicit. And the more I do that, I found the more people can process what I'm saying. But interestingly, the better the framework I give at the outset, the more I'm obligated to apply it consistently. So when I looked at the first version of my book, I could see, oh yeah, well, I wasn't really following what I would currently think of as the right framework as consistently as I now know how to do. And so upgrading the framework then meant upgrading the argument in all sorts of different ways. And the most significant way, I think, in which this has to happen, although there's a lot of different upgrades, is in the realm of policy. And this is where working system comes in. So there's a question, if somebody's a policymaker and they read Moral Case for Fossil Fuels, I want them to have some pretty concrete idea of this is what I should advocate. And I want them to have, to paraphrase Atlas Shrugged, I want them to have the words they need for the time that they'll need them. I guess that's almost a quote. You know, what Francisco says to Reardon. So what I think of it as, I want to make things clear enough, both in framework and in applying the framework and explaining things, that somebody, for example, can say, oh, this is why I'm against a carbon tax, and this is specifically what we should do about CO2 emissions, or not just we should allow nuclear, but here are some of the specifics in terms of a path forward to decriminalizing nuclear, or not just these air pollution standards are irrational, but here's what more rational air pollution standards look like. Because I remembered when I was younger, one thing I had a kind of pet peeve about in objectivism was people would ask about specific questions, and then sometimes people would say, oh, well, that's a task for the philosophy of law. And then I was thinking, well, like, where are these philosophers of law who are going to figure out all these issues? And I think when I'm writing a book, I don't know, I'm not exactly a philosopher of law, but like if I'm writing a book for somebody, I want that book to be useful. So I at least have to do to the best of my ability to give people a framework, not just a framework, but to give them actual conclusions that are usable. And what I've noticed and the thing that I'm working on most in the new book is probably how to broaden the concept of framework to policy framework. So giving people the right principles of policy to deal with energy and environmental issues, and then giving a lot of specific applications of those. But for this audience, since a lot of my goal is to motivate people to try to do this in other realms, I hope this idea of a working system hits home, that when you're thinking of creating something, think about the end user of, particularly in this context, ideas, and am I giving those ideas in a form that's actually useful in the complexity of their lives? Because if I don't do that, then I'm just kind of giving them an indication or a jolt or a motivation, but they're not able to actually use them. And so I think of using them as, you can think of it as, I want them to have a pretty concrete idea of what the right decision is in a specific situation, and I want them to have a pretty concrete ability to explain that to others. And I think that if you can do that in a subject, it's really powerful because it has a self-replicating kind of influence, because you can persuade somebody in a very meaningful way that something is true, but then you can also give them the way to do that to others. And I think The Moral Case did this a little bit, and I think that's responsible for a lot of its success, but my belief is that there's a much higher level that it can be done in the realm of energy and in other fields. And just to give you one other mental device that I think is useful, I think of, you've ever seen those bike locks that have 10 cylinders on them, like those cheap bike locks that, you know, you have to turn each one between 1 and 10? So I think of intellectual persuasion as like that bike lock. Like even if you open up 9 of them, the thing doesn't really open. You need to open up all 10. I think often with persuasion, it's if you get even almost all of the way there, it's totally different from everything opening up. And I think of a working system as everything opening up. And I've had moments in my life where I've been able to do that with other people, and the effect is really profound. So that's something that motivates me a lot, and it's causing me to invest a lot of time in a totally new version of this thing that's already been successful, because I believe maybe I can open all 10 cylinders of that lock. So I want to make sure we have plenty of time for questions. But the two big takeaways today are, one, that I hope this applies to everybody, that objectivist philosophy is a tool for profound clarity and therefore influence. And I mentioned, you know, back in 99 when I started getting interested in these things, there was still this idea that, oh, objectivism is a market liability. And I believe the way many people use it is as a market liability, but I believe at the core of it, it has this incredible clarifying power to take these crucial, complex, controversial, confusing issues and to make them clear in the same way that I felt that clarity at first when I read that passage of Ayn Rand to Barry Goldwater. And then the other thing is just that the moral case for fossil fuels is particularly important. Now, it probably shouldn't be your whole focus since there are a lot of other issues, but I've seen a bunch of I Love Fossil Fuel shirts, which I really appreciate. And I'm glad that, particularly among objectivists, that this has become an important cause, because this is a very fundamental value in our lives, and it's one that is very, very powerfully under attack, and we really do have the philosophical equipment to clarify people's thinking on that. So I hope that this has made you love fossil fuels a little bit more, and maybe even more importantly, love Ayn Rand a little bit more. Thank you. Oops. And we have a lot of, I think we have about half an hour for questions almost. Yes.
I've given up trying to talk to people who are advocating the Green New Deal and Alexandra Ocasio-Cortez, or occasional Cortex, as I've heard her referred to. But I talk about these issues with a lot of people, and I'm wondering what your advice would be for me. I have, on the one hand, a lot of people who come to me, climate alarmists, saying, it's getting hotter and hotter and hotter all the time, and I think they're using earthly data from weather stations close to heat sinks, whereas the satellite data say it's not getting warmer, quite the contrary. How do you talk to that group that says, that, well, it's getting hotter and hotter all the time, and all the facts are on our side, and we have the moral high ground?
So from the perspective of this presentation, I'll tell you how I'd react in a second, but I would think of it as, what framework are they coming from? And there are at least two ways in which I think framework is very prominent. So one is that, as you're indicating with what's called the urban heat island effect, that warming measurements can be distorted by local sources of heat. So that's at least something that historically has been an issue. But more broadly, that when that there's this incredible tendency towards sloppiness and exaggeration when it comes to changes in our climate conditions. That's definitely a thing. But then more broadly, they're not being even-handed and precise and human-focused in regard to the full context, because they're not looking at the positive. So the first thing I would just say is, be aware of where their distortions are, because then that can influence how you frame things. And there are different options with how you do that. But one thing, if I'm ever totally at sea on where to begin, I'll often just ask, okay, what do you think we should do about that? Like, what do you think we should concretely do about that? Because what that will do is that will get them to commit to a specific kind of action. And then you can talk about, okay, well, what framework should guide what kinds of actions we should choose? So yes, maybe if there's a problematic amount of warming, maybe we should do something about it. But do we also need to consider that billions of people need energy, and that if they don't have that energy, then any temperature is going to be fatal to them. And if they do have a lot of energy, they can probably deal with just about any temperature. But you always want to be aware of what's the framework that's guiding them and what framework could guide them. And then you want to figure out how to get that framed as early as possible. So one way is just asking, what do you think? By the way, I have a much better nickname for Ocasio-Cortez, which is, I hope this gets popularized. It's a little too impolite for me to just make a dedicated tweet, but I think she should be called Venezuela Ocasio-Cortez.
Brilliant, thank you.
Thank you very much for a very impressive presentation. I have a question. There's a deeper agenda to this whole movement, a moral philosophical agenda, I think that's very clear, and it's hatred of production. And under
a what of production?
Hatred of production.
Uh-huh.
And under that, hatred of capitalism. I think that's everywhere at the deeper level, which is not mentioned openly. Maybe it's not suitable for your book, but don't you agree that a deeper level of philosophical issue underneath all of this?
Is hatred for capitalism?
Yep, and hatred for production as such.
Well, I think hatred for production as such, but I mean, their explicit framework is pretty close to hatred for production as such. I mean, if you're saying war against impact, we want to minimize environmental impact, that's pretty easy to translate into it. So I wouldn't think of it as like, oh, they're really after the end of capitalism, and therefore this is just a means. I mean, I think of it as it's all kind of the same movement. I mean, Ayn Rand referred to it as the new left, but you've got this fundamentally anti-mind, anti-human movement that was historically focused on sacrificing the individual and his judgment and his freedom to the collective, and now is focused on sacrificing those to the planet, which is even a less plausible thing. But there's always been a kind of hostility toward production, but I think it's actually easier now to show that there's a hostility toward production because they say that. So definite, and then more broadly, I think it's very valuable, and it's something I want to do even more in my book, to explain to people what the mechanisms are that's producing the conclusions that they hear, particularly because they have such a majority kind of status. If you're telling somebody, hey, what you're hearing in the world, including from very smart, prestigious people, like, that's wrong. It's very helpful to have an explanation of why that's wrong. That's not just, oh, these are people are dumb, or these people are evil in some sort of primary sense. But if you have an idea, for example, of, oh, well, there are certain kinds of frameworks that people have that are often operating invisibly that most of us don't know that we're using, but then that can lead smart people into really wrong directions, that can be persuasive. Or you can say with government incentives, like even if people are trying to do the right thing, if you create a whole set of incentives around, let's figure out how much fossil fuels are screwing up the climate, you're gonna get a lot of smart people giving you reports on how much fossil fuels are screwing up the climate.
Thank you.
I assume you occasionally get the accusation that you can't be objective because you're paid by the fossil fuel industry. And I'm wondering, first of all, how do you answer that accusation, and what do you think is behind that and the implication that the university professors or the think tanks who put out catastrophic climate change stuff are objective because they don't get paid? Maybe some of them do get paid, I don't know. What is your thought of, like, what's wrong with the thinking behind that framework, and how do you actually answer that?
Really interesting question. So one thing that's anecdotally interesting is that I don't get that very often. And it's not like I hide my connection with the industry. I mean, I brag about it. I mean, I say, like, yes, we want to be the mastermind behind what the industry says, and so people pay me money, and I tell them what I think the truth is about their industry, and I tell them what I think they should say about the industry. But I think the core reason why I don't get that is because I have a view that comes across as sincere, and there's a very strong logic to why I came across with it, and part of it is that I give the framework first, and also part of it is I give the story even of how I came to the framework. I didn't give it in the same way here as I would to a normal audience, but I tell them about, okay, here's my background in philosophy, and here's how I thought of things. I tell them the truth about both my framework and my broader thought process. And then somebody really has to say, oh, well, you're just totally lying, right? None of that is true. Whereas if I just give an abstract argument in a vacuum, but there's no sense of where I'm coming from or my own process, then they can just say, oh yeah, somebody just sort of transplanted that onto your, you know, Exxon just gave you, I don't know, $100,000 to give us this kind of presentation. And one reason I want to emphasize that I don't get this and why is because I think that it's a good lesson that if you really tell the story of how you came, and I'm going to talk about this more in intellectual persuasion, what I call opinion stories, if you can tell the story of how you came to your opinion, that has a lot of positive impacts in terms of how well it goes over. It's also very hard to challenge, because if you tell me that what I'm saying is false, a lot of what you're telling me is that I'm lying. And it's actually about myself. And in a sense, you can't tell somebody you're lying about your own opinion story. You can say, I disagree with the way you came to your opinion, but it's a pretty hard thing to say, oh no, you're lying about the way you came to your opinion. That didn't actually happen. I know that, you know, Rex Tillerson some years ago, like, found you in, you know, Irvine and decided to make you his shill or something like that. Also, just one more thing about this in terms of effectiveness is I get, industry is always telling me, they're always telling me, hey, Alex, you have it so easy because you're not one of us. And if only we had this incredible gift of not being in the industry, then our lives would be so much easier. And I'll tell you what I tell them, which is I said, even if I was a lobbyist, I think I could be just as persuasive. And I'll give you my argument that I tell lobbyists when I teach workshops, you should say this. And if somebody says, hey, you know, I give a presentation, they say, hey, I don't agree with you because you're a lobbyist for the fossil fuel industry. And I say, yeah, I am a lobbyist. Do you know what a lobbyist does? You know, what does a lobbyist do? A lobbyist is somebody who advocates for certain political policies on behalf of a business or industry. And I say, imagine there's a situation where there's an industry that our whole lives depend on, like our food, our clothing, our shelter, our medical care, our enjoyment. Like, this industry has a direct connection between all of those things, and yet the whole world misunderstands it and thinks that industry is bad for them. Like, wouldn't you want a heroic lobbyist to come along and help that industry tell the truth. And I say, well, that's me. Like, I'm that superhero who's coming to help this industry tell the truth. So that's the key to addressing it. I think your question mostly answered itself in terms of the later parts. There's a general fundamental view that interest and objectivity are at odds. And so people have this idea of government, sort of government and academics as having no interest. And it's not true in the sense they talk about that interest distorts objectivity, but what I do think is legitimate is to be aware, what I tell people when they talk about this is, you should be aware about all potential incentives that can easily distort people's thinking. So I say it's absolutely legitimate to consider my incentives, and you want to consider other incentives too, including what's often overlooked is status incentives. How if somebody today says that, hey, I don't believe we're causing a climate catastrophe, hey, I love fossil fuels, that can diminish them in all sorts of ways. And you want to be afraid of being in a society where coming to certain conclusions or even certain kinds of directions will immediately strip everybody of massive status because that creates motivation. So I would say there are problems with the way they're thinking about it with capitalism, but one way to get out of that is to just say, hey, I agree we should look at all sorts of incentives, and then you have to judge with a particular person, are those incentives operating? I can't just accuse an academic of succumbing to certain incentives, nor can he accuse me.
Thank you.
Hi, Alex. Thank you for your work, and I appreciate your presentation. One thing that comes clear to me from listening to you today, Ayn Rand tells us to check our premises. And it seems like when you walk people through your framework, there's an assumption of a certain logical premise underneath it, which is maximizing human flourishing is a shared value.
Mm-hmm.
In my interactions with a lot of progressive people or hearing how, you know, Ocasio-Cortez or others describe their value system, it's almost like they prefer for us to be the less intrusive sharing neighbor to animals and to trees and so on. So would you say that they don't necessarily share your primacy of humans as our motivation? And if that's common, or do you think that's common, and what do you say to those?
I think it's really important that an objectivist, that if you look at, say, Leonard Peikoff's book on objectivism, right, there's a certain structure and it has metaphysics and epistemology first and human nature, and then it goes into ethics. There's a certain idea that the way we think about values is related to certain assumptions about how reality is, how the mind works, what human nature is. This is very relevant in this context too, that particularly what I mentioned, the views people have about the nature of humans and the nature of our environment, that's going to be very related to how they even conceptualize the idea of human flourishing. Because if you think that human beings are polluter parasites and you believe that nature is stable, safe, and sufficient, then it makes a lot of sense to say, yeah, value-wise, what we should be doing is impacting things as little as possible. Just like, I don't know, bacteria in a petri dish should try to like impact it as little as possible because it only can survive so much with that petri dish. It's that little kind of universe. So often when I'm talking to people, I don't just say, hey, human flourishing, and that's it. Now, human flourishing resonates with a lot of people, but I want to get at, is what's going wrong is they think that human beings pursuing flourishing is inevitably self-destructive. And then if they think that, then I can talk to them about that. And it's actually pretty easy to make certain points, like on the resources side, hey, nature doesn't give us a fixed amount of resources. We actually create resources by turning unusable raw materials into resources. And you can ask, like, hey, is aluminum a natural resource? And they'll say, of course. And like, well, no, aluminum wasn't a resource 200 or 300 years ago, even though it's one of the most abundant metal elements in the ground, we made it. And it's like coal, oil, gas, uranium. They weren't resources until we made them resources. And then on the pollution side, you can get the idea of, oh, well, like it's the North Korea versus South Korea. Actually, people who live in a more natural environment have more pollution. They have pollution from nature. And then in climate, you can make the point, well, we're much safer from climate than we've ever been. So I think that part of making the point about human flourishing as a standard, it's not just a sentence in a vacuum. It's based on a certain understanding of how the world works and how human life works.
And if they don't prefer human flourishing?
Well, if given that, I mean, it's kind of, there's an analogy to, this is a whole big subject, but how I think selfishness could be explained. Like, a huge part of why people think are against selfishness is because they think that it's inherently sacrificial. So they don't have, you know, in Fountainhead you have the idea of the creator versus the second-hander. Like, people just have the idea, they have selfishness as Peter Keating at his worst. Like, that's what they think of selfishness. And they think, well, yeah, of course, if people pursue their self-interest, then they're going to have all these conflicts, and so then they need to sacrifice. But then if you get the idea, oh, wait, no, there's such a thing as mutually beneficial selfishness. And so, like, everyone can benefit, and nobody has to sacrifice. Like, if they really get that, and they say, no, I really still want to sacrifice. Like, I need more misery. It's not necessary, but I just still want it. Then that's pretty... there's not much to do with that person. But most people won't do that. So I think if people actually understand the nature of human flourishing, they're much more likely to embrace it. Another thing is see if they'll actually embrace, try to get them to concretize their ideal, you know, like I did with North Korea and South Korea and the family and New York. Like, people usually will not commit to being green as a consistent thing. So if you give them a positive that can incorporate the legitimate values that being green appeals to, I think it's very persuasive. Okay, I'm told we have 10 minutes for all of these questions. I don't know how that's going to happen, but I don't know how I'm going to satisfy all of you. You can try to hunt me down later, but I'll try to do a couple quick ones.
All right. So I have a question about what you think about the future of the green movement, and point that Ayn Rand brings out that comes to mind is that in a given irrational view, the more consistent view ends up winning out. So take, for instance, the so-called reliable energy you have, wind and solar, and to scale to replace fossil fuels altogether, would need a huge impact on the environment.
Uh-huh.
So do you see the future of the green movement having to abandon their defense of wind and solar for something even more radical than what we currently see, or is this something that is left to be determined?
Well, okay, let me, two things about that. Remind me that as a second thing. I was going to say the second thing is more important, then I'm going to forget the second thing. So I'll do the second thing first, which I've already forgotten. Now the second thing is that a huge part of my approach to ideas and to persuasion is that, and this goes to the point of the more consistent idea winning, is that I want to have a positive ideal that can be practiced 100% consistently. So when I talk about human flourishing, and I'll often use the expression, I don't want to save the planet from human beings, I want to improve the planet for human beings, then that gives me the moral high ground. And in my different stuff on communication, some of which I'll send out, I have this concept of arguing to 100 versus arguing to 0. And arguing to 100 means that you define the ideal, and then you argue that your course of action is the best way to get there, versus letting the other side define the ideal and then just arguing that, oh, unfortunately, it's impossible. So one, the biggest lesson is if we define a positive ideal, that's going to be much more consistent than the green ideal, which can't be practiced. And it's also just pro-human versus anti-human. So I think it can really win out. And then with wind and solar, yeah, they're anti-impact. So of course, if wind and solar became practical, then they're going to start to point out, oh my gosh, this is having so much environmental impact, right? And that already happens on a local kind of NIMBY level. But I mean, since we're human beings, and I think we can take that occasion to say, yeah, wait, this whole idea of anti-impact is the wrong way of thinking about it. So I think it's a vulnerable movement, but it has its penetration into the educational system, the media system is immense. So I think there's some fundamental weaknesses, but it has a very big head start.
Thank you very much.
Sure.
I worry about the next version of the Green New Deal. That keeps me up at night.
Yeah, the Green New Deal is the popularity of it and the lack of a real response from the other side is terrifying. It's part of what motivates me to have in book form like a more positive and concrete alternative.
Yeah, Alex. There are people who are more motivated by their love of the outdoors and doing outdoor activities, and they're concerned that climate change is going to impact them. So have you considered appealing to them by saying, or showing how much fossil fuels enables them to enjoy the outdoors with more security, or would you consider another approach to showing these people the benefits of fossil fuels?
Well, yeah, that's a good point. And no, I definitely think it's a good idea, and it's one that's very resonant to me. I mean, my lifestyle is very oriented toward being outside a lot. I mean, even just where I live in Laguna Beach, and I like
surf.
What's that?
You surf?
I don't surf, unfortunately.
Oh, I thought you were trying.
I one wheel.
Okay, never mind.
Yeah, I one wheel. I'll learn to surf. I'm not a great swimmer, but it's somewhat derivative. I like, so I personally just, I'm probably unusually, I have an unusually strong preference for being outside, and I get pretty uncomfortable inside. So I myself think of it very much in that way. Like, one thing is fossil fuels give me climate choice. Right? I can choose where to be most of the time in terms of where I live, and then I can also go around other places. So there are some passages in the first book about basically how, you know, the level of access to energy that we have, or energy abundance that we have, the level of empowerment that we have, that's given us this ability to truly enjoy the natural world, which doesn't exist if you're just stuck in one place, vulnerable to the elements, you can't move around. It's not like, even if you live in what we would call a super nice place, it's not a nice place from a human flourishing perspective. So I think it is really important to own that issue, and your question is a good reminder for me to do it more.
Okay, thank you.
Hey, Alex, Fred.
Early in your talk, you, in passing, mentioned that those you engage with might use the term stakeholder, and you implied that
yes.
You disagree with that. I wonder if you could share your evaluation of that term and if you offer any alternatives when you engage with people who use it.
Yeah, I singled out Fred because we used to walk, I think, didn't we walk to chemistry class together freshman year at Duke?
Yeah.
Yeah, and so that's at the same time I was discovering this, and he was in our Objectivist Club there. So now I forgot the question. Oh, about stakeholders.
Stakeholders.
See, the term stakeholder is it's one of those things where there's the idea of the shareholder theory of value, which is how a company should orient itself, and like, should it be focused primarily on shareholders, definitely, and versus, should it be focused on like the world as a whole, as some sort of collective stakeholders, because somehow everybody is impacted by Apple, so Apple should make its decisions in this collectivist way. I mean, basically they're trying for voluntary collectivism, right? Instead of the government sacrificing you to the group by some arbitrary standard, you have to make up your own way of sacrificing yourself to the group. So that I totally disagree with, but the term when I'm doing communications, when I'm helping people with communications, the term actually, it's a decent shorthand, because what it captures is there are all of these groups that unfortunately impact the company a lot that it has to take cognizance of, much more than I wish. So for example, and sometimes it's borderline, like you think about, you can think of a stakeholder in a drilling project. And there's some legitimacy there. I mean, it's people's community, and so you have to make sure that you engage in certain practices that are gonna protect people's rights. And so I'll talk about it in that context. But in terms of a theory of what the purpose of a company should be, I totally disagree with it.
Thank you.
Okay.
Hey, Alex.
Hey.
So your framework for when I'm talking with an environmentalist is very helpful. Getting out in the open, our standard of value, talking about human flourishing. And then it will often go into some specific example of, so they'll bring up something very esoteric, such as the effect of, say, straws or glyphosate or something about bee colonies or the Great Barrier Reef, something which I personally have no idea.
Yeah.
And it's very difficult with such an abstract thing. I can only seem to get some other authority so that from my own perspective, because I don't know what's actually going on.
Uh-huh.
So these are very, you have to know the specific details. And so having an abstract framework is only so helpful. You can only say, well, we should do what's best for human flourishing, but there's no way to really answer them.
Well, yeah, so I mean, one thing is, I mean, in general, if I know nothing about an issue, I'm not gonna have a conversation about that issue. Like, if there's something in semiconductors and like I know nothing about it, and I have a general moral framework, I can say certain things about that, but I'm not gonna get into a discussion about that specific thing. So if you're having a discussion generally about frameworks for thinking about industrial or environmental issues, then I would want to focus on concrete issues that I know about. And as a layman, there's a lot you can know about, like energy sources. And certainly you can read my work and learn a lot more. But there are certain things you can just observe about the role of fossil fuels in our lives that can make really clear, okay, is somebody really being even-handed and precise and looking at all the options? Or are they being biased and sloppy and probably driven by these assumptions and values? So I would focus on those specific ones. And yeah, I mean, so I wouldn't have it as I need to be capable of having a magnificent result in every conversation, even where I don't know anything about the specifics. But usually that's not necessary. And usually if they're just bringing that up as like one of a grab bag of things.
That's exactly what they do.
That's what?
That's exactly what they do.
Yeah, but then you want to have a clear idea of what the purpose of the conversation is. So when I mentioned sometimes if I get lost, I'll just ask, okay, like, what do you think we should do? Because ultimately all the discussions are discussions about action. And if you can get somebody to commit to, oh, this is a specific course of action, then you can start to talk about that. And for example, in the realm of energy, when people say something like, oh, I love solar, like they're often, one thing that's going on there is there people are advocating a fantasy. They're committing you to a course of action. They're saying like, oh, well, you support continuing to use fossil fuels. Oh, and I love solar. But what does that love manifest? You're comparing an action to a fantasy. So you can never have a conversation where you're comparing an action to a fantasy, certainly not where you're giving a fantasy the high ground. So you have to ask, okay, but what does your love for solar translate into? Does it mean that, hey, you're going to become a solar entrepreneur and you're going to try to have a breakthrough and that you're going to try to sell it to me without government coercion? If it's that's fantastic. I'm glad you're pursuing that love. But if that love means, you know, I'm not allowed to drive a gasoline car or I'm forced to put solar panels on my roof, and even though that's an increased fire hazard, and even though I think it's screwing my neighbors over, and even though it's driving up our prices, like, I think that's wrong. So in general, just with this power, as long as you're choosing to have the right conversations, framing the conversation can be incredibly powerful. One more thing. Oh, sorry. Just in case you are against writing something on a piece of paper, or for those of you watching online, if you want the resources from this talk or otherwise want to get in touch with me, you can just email alex@alexepstein.com, subject OCON 2019, and that way my team will know to send you the resources. Great to be here. I'll be around for another day or two, and thank you for having me.
Thanks for listening to the Ayn Rand Institute Live podcast. Subscribe on iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever you listen. You can also find us on YouTube. If you like this content, please share or leave us a review. For more information, go to AynRand.org.